Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
To coin a phrase, oh, Jeremy Corbyn. It's been a once-in-a-generation triumph for the Conservative Party, but a once-in-its-history disaster for Labour. It's Labour's fourth successive election defeat, and they were facing a Conservative Party which had already been in power for nearly a decade. Labour gained just one new seat in the whole country and lost nearly 60. Burnley, Bolsover, Blythe Valley, Redcar, Darlington, Dudley North, Great Grimsby, the Labour heartlands have turned blue. People inside the party aren't holding back. They say it's not their worst election result since 1983, not since 1935, but their worst election result ever, bar none. The temptation is to race ahead. When's Jeremy Corbyn going to leave? Who are the runners and riders to replace him? But first, let's pause and let's examine the anatomy of a catastrophe. I'm Basha Cummings, and welcome to the Tortoise Podcast. 5 weeks ago, on the hunch that the Corbyn project was headed for disaster, we commissioned Britain's most experienced political journalist, Phil Webster, to get into the Labour Party machine, to rummage through his contacts book and find out how it looked on the inside. Phil's going to join me in this podcast to dissect where it all went wrong for Labour, but first, let's start in sunnier times. Glastonbury, June 27th, 2017. This is after Labour has just lost that year's general election and the British rapper Stormzy is on stage, but the crowd has taken over.
Oh, Jeremy Corbyn. Hey.
So remarkably, last night in Conservative headquarters, people had stolen that anthem and they were singing Oh Isaac Levido, and that's the strategist who had run and delivered the Tory campaign. And defeated Labour candidates and old-timers in the party were singing a very different tune.
There's no hiding place from the result of the election this evening. It's devastating for our party. It's devastating for the communities that we seek to represent. And frankly, it's devastating for our country.
I actually don't think I ever expected it to be this bad, but for it to be bad, and I'm devastated. That I don't know how you could have any other reaction other than being utterly heartbroken.
I never dreamt for a moment that we would go below 200 seats. I mean, that is terrible and gone backwards.
Those were the current Labour MPs Keir Starmer and Jess Phillips, and former Labour Cabinet Minister Alan Johnson. So there's the journey, from chants of adulation at Glastonbury to a chorus of despair. Chris Cook, fellow editor of mine here at Tortoise, has been up all night. Chris, are they right? How bad is it?
So there are a couple of ways to think about this as a problem, and all of them tell you this is incredibly bad. So the simplest and easiest way to think of it is that we're 9 years into a Tory government, and the main opposition party has just lost 59 seats. This really isn't supposed to happen. At this point in the cycle, you'd expect that the opposition would basically be naturally eroding the base of the government. The thing is, though, actually, I think it's just looking at that headline number, 59 seats. First past the post has this effect known as the squeeze effect, right? So when there are two clear parties in the lead in a seat in an election, when you next hold a vote, those two parties spend a lot of their time telling people who want to vote for the third or fourth or fifth party, don't bother. This is first past the post. Voting for them is a waste of time. And it means it's just really hard, if you're in those lower slots, to break out of those slots. And one of the reasons why Labour activists should be pretty glum today, one of the many reasons, is that basically they were the main opposition party in most of the country. They were in first or second place in 560 odd seats yesterday. Today, they're in first or second place in only about 500. So there are about 60 seats, a huge wedge of the country, where they are in a really bad place. There's been sort of focus on the loss of seats, you know, in the northeast where they lost 7 seats, or in the northwest where they lost 13 seats. But actually, the loss of the second places is pretty pronounced in places like the southeast in particular, where the Liberals have swept under their feet. There are about 30 seats there where they were the main opposition, and now they're in third place.
So, Chris, it sounds like what you're saying is this is a 10-year issue for Labour, not just to the next election.
There's like a non-linearity in first past the post, which means that switching ranks, going from second place to third place, is a big deal, and it makes it exponentially harder. You can't say that there's not going to be a 20-point swing one way, then, you know, a 20-point swing back the other way is impossible. But if there is going to be a swing back against the Tories in lots of these places, it's not going to be Labour who are properly placed to exploit that energy.
What is the point of the Labour Party if we don't respect and represent those voices? People we have not listened to or respected enough.
It's the worst night for the Labour Party since 1935. And I want to apologise to all those people, because we, the Labour Party, have failed to deliver the Labour government that I think that so many people were hoping and praying for.
Desperately, desperately disappointed. I am surprised in some ways, but unsurprised in others.
Look, I'm extremely honoured that the people of Walthamstow have yet again voted for me to be their MP, and acutely conscious they don't just need a Labour MP, they need a Labour government. And I can't pretend that what is happening across the rest of the country isn't absolutely devastating. I'm gutted to see very, very good colleagues who I know, just like me, are passionate about their local communities, passionate about this country, not being returned to Parliament.
So that was Caroline Flint, Chris Bryant, Ian Lavery and Stella Creasy. For Labour, this is shocking but not a surprise. And in fact, thanks to a smart call by my fellow editor here at Tortoise, Dave Taylor, for weeks we've had one of Britain's best political reporters, the best, we'd say, Phil Webster, preparing for exactly this moment. He hasn't been writing daily updates about Labour during the campaign, but he's been talking to some of their top people, getting inside their election team to understand their strategy, and he's here with me. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Welcome. When did things start to go really wrong for Corbyn? After that sort of strange post-defeat high in 2017, and when did people inside the Labour machine know it?
I think a lot of people in the Labour Party suspected it even then, and they were surprised by how well Labour had done in 2017. But it took some time to convince Corbyn and the people around him that he hadn't actually won that election. Mm. They behaved as if they'd won it for quite a long time. Now, what's happened is that the public have had another 2.5 years to get to know this guy, and they don't particularly like what they see. There have been huge questions placed over his patriotism. If you ask me what the one big incident that went really wrong for Corbyn and saw his public image take a big knock, it was the way he handled the Salisbury poisoning.
Yeah.
His failure then to come out and condemn what was obviously a state-backed move left people thinking, God, is this guy really pro-British? Is he patriotic? And that patriotism question was hanging over him for so long.
How did they not realise that sooner? You know, that was more than, you know, nearly 18 months ago now.
It was. I think they have realised it sooner. I think the mass enthusiasm among the young for Corbyn on the university campuses, whatever, has long gone. I think people, the question marks over him have been there. But the party apparatchiks didn't catch up with this change of mood. They thought that Corbyn could go out there and do it again in late 2019, as he had done in 2017.
As it became clear that he was losing support and they were sort of really hunkering down, the people close to him, perhaps burying their heads in the sand, and you heard people like Ian Austin going on the BBC.
There's only two people who can be Prime Minister on December the 13th, Jeremy Corbyn or Boris Johnson. And I think Jeremy Corbyn is completely unfit to lead our country. completely unfit to lead the Labour Party. And after 34 years of, I joined the Labour Party as a teenager. I worked for the Labour Party. You know, in my 30s, I was a government advisor. In my 40s, I was an MP and a minister. But so it's really come to something when I tell decent, traditional, patriotic Labour voters that they should be voting for Boris Johnson at this election.
How did he cope with attacks as sort of as violent as that? And how did they not realise at that moment that things were going badly wrong?
Well, they knew it was bad, but they chose to ignore it. Mm. And Ian Austin and John Woodcock, his Labour colleague, by coming out and saying to Labour people, you should be voting Boris Johnson because he's safer, that obviously struck a chord. It caught the mood in Labour areas, this feeling that the guy who now leads the party that their fathers and mothers and grandparents had always supported wasn't actually necessarily a great supporter of the UK.
But did they then try and make decisions about where not to deploy him or how to better deploy him? I mean, how did that trickle into the way in which they started to run the campaign differently?
I think the people, from what I picked up, was that the people running the campaign, the people who really mattered running the campaign, are all true Corbynites. These were the people who made the decisions as to where he went. And I suppose even though they knew there was a toxicity about their leader, they couldn't avoid putting him out there. And they hoped that he could work the magic in their eyes that he'd worked in 2017. But the main concern of these Corbynites around the leader was not to give prominence to members of the shadow cabinet who took a different view on Europe than the line that had been painfully agreed in the run-up to the election.
My role and the role of our government will be to ensure that that referendum is held in a fair atmosphere, and we will abide by the result of it. And I will adopt, as Prime Minister if I am at the time, a neutral stance so that I can credibly carry out the results of that to bring our communities and country together.
He would stay neutral about a negotiated settlement of which he'd been in charge. It was laughable. It was hopeless.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't last. And there were, for that reason, the Team Corbyn decided that those people who took a strong Remain
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Safe, efficient and reliable railways help to keep us all connected, thanks to Network Rail. Yet, maintenance on the railways is a risky and sometimes fatal business. At Network Rail, two previous attempts to invigorate its track worker safety programs had failed, leaving employees feeling sceptical that the organisation could ever get railway safety right. Since 2019, EY teams have worked with Network Rail to deliver a transformation that improved safety protocols and changed employee behaviour around safety. Network Rail RailHub, a new digital safety platform and app, eliminated inaccurate paper trails and worked offline, so it could be used by workers in remote locations. Since the platform was introduced, near misses affecting maintenance workers on the railways have fallen by 40%. Read the full story at ey.com.
Position like Emily Thornberry, like Keir Starmer, the shadow foreign secretary, the shadow Brexit secretary, were kept in the cupboard, as I as I've said, and so we had this weird business going on of Northern pro-Brexit spokesmen being put out, particularly late in the campaign, to try and counter what they had by then picked up, which was this antipathy in the Leave areas, where formerly they'd been Labour MPs, to the fact that they had changed the policy. It all happened too late.
Okay, so let's move to the sort of the cast of people around Corbyn, because as you said, this was a failure of leadership, but he was sort of propped up by some key figures. What were the arguments playing out between them? And you've characterised it in an article that you've written for Tortoise Today as a kind of kamikaze battle plan.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, from the start, there was among that strategy team in Labour Southside headquarters, there was fear that they were ignoring the seats that they held in the North. They felt that by going for an all-out offensive strategy, in the belief that they could do a repeat of 2017, would fail. But you then had Carrie Murphy taking over the whole campaign, and daily meetings, daily phone calls with the Corbyn team, and they deluded themselves for far too long into thinking that they could gain seats rather than hold on to what they'd got. And it was with only about, I think, less than 2 weeks before the election, when the big poll came out showing that Labour was doing very badly in its heartlands, that they finally changed strategy and they started directing the money that had gone to trying to win impossible seats in the South and elsewhere. They directed that money back to the North. They put the campaigning resources back in the North, but it all turned out to be far too late. They needed to be doing that from the start. The big tension was between those who felt they should defend, and they lost out in the internal argument, and those who thought they should attack.
But what was that attacking principle based on? I mean, where was the what confidence was feeding that attacking strategy?
Was it a
belief in Corbyn?
Yeah, it was a belief in Corbyn. It was a belief in his campaigning ability. It was a belief that once the dreaded media was forced to give them fairer treatment, this is their view, just as in 2017, they surprised the doubters, they'd be able to do that again and do it better because they were starting from a better position. They genuinely felt that they could increase their tally of seats and deny Johnson his majority. They thought that they really thought that was possible.
So when that strategy shifted, and it became clear that things were going pretty badly, how much attention was then shifted to preserving Corbynism, to the project, as much as to winning a campaign, an election campaign?
Well, I think it was very noticeable that on the day that it emerged through various briefings that the strategy had changed, the party then said that more prominence would be given to the likes of Rebecca Long-Bailey, Angela Rayner, Laura Pidcock, Richard Bergen, people who were known to be Eurosceptic, Leavers, Northern. And these are the people who the group around Corbyn wanted to see promoted and will hope that they'll carry on the flame after he's gone. The scale of the defeat, in my opinion, makes that less likely than it was. But there is no doubt that those people that they said they were giving greater prominence to later in the campaign are the people who will be out there, first of all, trying to succeed him.
Yeah.
They will alter the message. They will be, I think, more palatable to the voting public than Corbyn. But they've made a running start because they're the people who are out there during the campaign.
Phil, thank you very much for joining us. So where do we go from here? When Ed Miliband was defeated in 2015, he said very simply, "I take absolute and total responsibility for our defeat." and he resigned straight away, even though some people were advising him not to. Jeremy Corbyn hasn't done that. He's promised not to lead Labour into the next general election, as if that was really an option, but he hasn't taken responsibility in the same way, and he's staying on as leader to oversee a period of quiet reflection, as he's called it. I'm joined by Matt D'Ancona, another one of my fellow editors here at Tortoise. Matt, what's really going on here?
Well, Corbyn has decided to stick around for what he calls a period of reflection. Now, I think that he should spend a lot of time of that period of reflection looking at his reflection in the bathroom mirror. But I think what that's code for is a period of time where he, as the continuing to be the figurehead of the defeated left-wing faction, can, as it were, try and engineer a successor who is in his ideological model. And they'll want him to hang around as long as possible. Actually, this is unrealistic because he is going to be the subject of that reflection. And he really can't be the chairman of the inquiry committee. Mm. He can't mark his own homework. The process of electing a new Labour leader does take a while.
But how does that actually work? So who controls the process for deciding the next leader?
What happens is that you have to be, the candidates have to be nominated by 10% of the parliamentary party, the MPs, and the MEPs. So roughly, in this case, sort of 21, 22, something like that. And then it goes out to the membership, who are 485,000 or so. Mm. And it's done on a kind of knockout system. And the whole process can take a number of months. So normally the best thing to do is for the leader that's lost to step down and for an acting leader to preside over the process, like Harriet Harman did, for example. And so I think that something like that might happen in this instance.
Maybe John McDonnell.
Someone like that. Yeah, I mean, someone who doesn't have a dog in the fight is definitely not in the race and, you know, but has the authority to preside over the process.
So we're getting a clear picture now about how the Labour left are explaining this defeat, and they're obviously saying it's about Brexit, not a repudiation of economic policies, some even saying it's not to do with Corbyn. I mean, what do you think to that?
Well, I think it's nonsense, but it was inevitable because the whole project, the whole Corbyn project, was more geared to gaining control of the party and its machinery and embedding Corbynite ideology into that than it was about getting into government. Very predictably, the left have rushed out immediately after the exit poll to say this is all the fault of centrists and Blairites and the media. But if there's to be an answer to this, the left has to be held to account as much as any other dominant faction has been in the past. It's not good at that. It does have control of the party. And what will be interesting to see is how far the membership of the party pressure the sort of dominant factions to say, look, you know, this is really serious. This is an extinction level event. We do need to have an honest conversation about the future, because Labour tends to do well when it embraces the future. It you know, it won in 1945, it won in 1964, it won in 1997. In this election, it looked very much backwards. It looked like an old-fashioned party. Mm. And I think the members, you know, who are not all extraordinarily left-wing in the sense that they, you know, they have no open-mindedness, will you know, they want to get back into power. Yeah. They'll want to deal with reality. And so it will be a very interesting debate, I think.
Thanks, Matt. So all of this leaves one final question, and that is, if the left isn't lefty and it's not avowedly socialist, then what's on offer? James Harding, founder of Tortoise and my editor, is here. Where do we go from here, James? Where does it take us?
Well, Bashar, I think into the great unknown, because the curious thing about this election is that there was one party with a really radical agenda, a manifesto of serious changes, nationalisations, reconfiguration of the role of the state, and that was Jeremy Corbyn's Labour. Mm. And by contrast, Boris Johnson's manifesto lacked ambition if it were a letter to Santa. It didn't tell you much about what he wanted to do beyond getting Brexit done. And so we now have a government which is really quite unpredictable. It's got a faction of it that is, if you like, small state Tories, but there's a big part of Boris Johnson's government that really does want to remake the public square, that's willing to intervene on issues of infrastructure, that's got to deliver for these new Tory constituencies in the north. So you don't know what the Tory offer is, And of course, as a result, you also now don't know what the Labour offer is. Yeah. And the old social democratic offer of some way in which the state intervenes to offset the excesses of the market, that's no longer on the table.
Mm.
And the 2020s are going to be remade in the centre and on the left in light of what technology is doing to us, in the light of the climate crisis, in the light of who we think we are, and the extent to which we're getting older as a society. So strangely enough, there is something potentially energising, I think, in all of this, that at the end of this very, very long night...
You're the first person to say that, I
have to say. Well, a very long night, you actually have to stand back and say, look, politics for a while is over. We're not going to have elections every few, feels like every few years, but feels like every few minutes. We're going to have a period where there's a party in power for 5 years. And so people are either going to put their energy into rethinking other parties, Lib Dems and Labour,
yeah,
or what I suspect, those passions around politics are going to move into activism, and they're going to move into activism around causes. And that gives people like us, an opportunity to do something.
That's a lovely, hopeful place to end this podcast. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Basha.
Podcasts aren't the only thing that we do at Tortoise. We also publish articles every day on our app and online. And we're a slow news publisher, so we're interested in what's driving the news, not breaking news. And if listening to this has made you want to learn more about us, then please go to tortoisemedia.com/friend and use the code POD50 to become a member for just £1 a week. That's half our usual price.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organization, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimize the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hi, I'm investigative journalist Nicola Tallant, host of Crime World, a podcast all about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Join me and my guests for a peek into the world of gangland crime, dirty money, and mysterious cold cases. With 5 brand new episodes per week, and sometimes even more, there's something for every type of crime podcast enthusiast. You can listen to Crime World now, wherever you get your podcasts.